Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and you're listening to Stages, the podcast that converses...
The reality of that eight-show-a-week slog is really hard.
When I start on a character, I have to draw them, and I'm not an artist.
This is, in effect, built in myth and mystery.
So you'd be sitting in this tiny little bio box with radiators all around you.
Which was a funny thing, because I don't think that play would have happened in that way if it wasn't at Griffin.
You're a bit different to the other girls in this area.
Yes, I thought, yes, I am.
That was the days when they could smell an actor or a singer and think, oh, I've got 6 weeks.
My sisters really taught me that I had to be versatile.
This ostrich, pink ostrich feather sticking up out of my hair, out of this wig.
My first career, as it were, was preparation for my second career.
And her face was beaming. It was just beaming at me.
I hadn't lost any of my passion or love for it, so it's been a joy to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and welcome to Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives about craft and career. Award-winning vocalist Emma Pask has firmly established herself as one of Australia's favourite voices in jazz. Her effortless, honest stage presence combined with her powerful vocal ability leaves audiences spellbound and inspired whenever she takes to the stage. While Emma's voice and style are unique and individually her own, her performances are reminiscent of the classic era of jazz, when swing was top of the charts. Her talent was first spotted by the internationally renowned jazz great James Morrison when she was just 16 years old. She joined his band as the lead vocalist and went on to spend a solid 20 years touring the world with Morrison. Despite her achievements and the international recognition of her talent, Emma retains her natural, refreshing and unpretentious positive attitude to life. Jazz virtuoso James Morrison says of Emma, "Whilst it's fashionable to be a jazz singer these days, Emma is the real thing."
Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad, próspero año y felicidad. Feliz Navidad, feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad, próspero año y felicidad. Celebremos juntos la vida. Y que viva la alegría. Feliz Navidad desde el fondo de mi corazón. I wanna wish you a Merry Christmas. I wanna wish you a Merry Christmas. I wanna wish you a Merry Christmas. From the bottom of my heart.
Wonderful. Whatever. Yeah, if I get rambly, or if I'm terrible about remembering things, pretty bad.
People are always concerned about getting rambly, but
yeah,
that's the way it goes.
Is it?
Sometimes.
A good old ramble.
Are you a rambler?
I think I might be a ramble.
Rambling Rose?
Yeah, a little bit.
Emma Pask, welcome to Stages.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you for joining us. Today, on your Facebook page, you had a beautiful post about volunteering at Wayside Bondi.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
Yeah. It's Christmas time, of course, a time when there are a lot of people that are doing it tough in the world, homeless people. Who don't have a great Christmas to look forward to.
Indeed.
But the Wayside does wonderful stuff every year for those less fortunate than ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
How did you become involved with Wayside in Bondi?
Well, yeah, it's a really... it's an interesting story. It's been, about 3 years, 2.5 years now probably since I started. And I guess you could say it was one of those good things that came out of a rather unfortunate circumstance. You know, the world shut down in 2020, as we know, with good old COVID. I think I posted that, didn't I, say when COVID arrived on our shores in 2020. I was, like so many other, you know, musicians and performers, we were all knocked for six, so to speak.
Every artist in the world, it was a tough time.
That's right.
Theatres, concert venues,
yeah.
Pubs, spaces where people gather.
Yeah.
And of course, the first thing to go during a plague is any public spaces where
which is what we so heavily rely on, yeah, with what we do for a living. You're right. And it just got worse and worse as the year went on.
Yeah.
As it hit, everything changed. And I found myself getting really, as everyone did, we were all concerned for ourselves. But then we were deeply concerned for the world, for everyone. You know, I remember vividly one night, you know, being on the living room floor with my husband, just sort of in his arms, just sobbing, you know, because it was just so heavy, the weight of the world, what was happening, you know, trying to work out everything and feeling completely overwhelmed.
Well, an important part for an artist is that vocal expression or physical expression, whatever they do, paint, dance, sing.
Sure.
And you're prevented from doing that. So
yeah, connection, you know, it's such a big part.
It's bound to sort of weigh up inside.
I think that's what it was. Yeah,
there's no outlet.
Yeah, you're right. Looking back in hindsight, it was. It was all of those things just having to be bottled up and then just exploding, just letting go, you know, and feeling completely helpless for not only yourself but for everyone else. Like if I can't, and also then that feeling, if I can't help myself, how am I going to help others? That kind of thing. And I luckily have a really great physical outlet in ocean swimming. I adore ocean swimming. I'm a bit of an addict.
You're part of icebergs.
I am. I'm a Bondi iceberg. Yep, an official Bondi iceberg. I've done my time, done my winter races.
So any day in the year, you're up and you're in the surf?
Pretty much every day that I can. Yeah, any day that will allow me conditions, you know, conditions, however they are, and also if I'm in town, if I'm home, I'll do it. But yeah, I've been ocean swimming for many, many years before I moved to Bondi, which is over 12 years ago now, I think. Before then, I'd been, you know, been swimming since I was young. I was a nipper in North Cronulla nippers and things like that growing up. But luckily, I had this physical outlet of swimming. But then also, at one point, that got shut down with beaches closing. It was just the whole world was, you know, closing down. And I remember being at icebergs with our mates. We might have actually been on the beach in North Bondi because we were prevented from going to the club because, you know, that was a public gathering space. We weren't allowed to enter the club. We'd be hanging on the beach one day and I'd be saying to one of my fellow icebergs, Rob Schneider, who's a lovely mate, I was just sort of, you know, going through the woes of my life and work and job and all these things and all this, you know, pressure I felt and this deep sadness. And I just wanted to get out of myself and away from myself and my worries and do something for someone else, you know, thinking that that is the way to go, you know, that maybe will pull me out of a funk and then I'll be helping someone else, you know, this is a way to go. And so Rob was listening to me ramble on, as I do, and he said to me, what are you doing on Thursday at 8 o'clock? And I said, well, obviously nothing, Rob, because the world shut down. And he said, well, meet me here. And I didn't know where here was. That was Wayside Chapel in Bondi Beach. I didn't even know there was one. I knew Wayside in King's Cross. And Rob had been volunteering there for years and he'd never said a word about it. I've known him for so many years. We swim together all the time. We think we know so much about people, but he just kept his volunteering to himself. It's just something that he did. So I got there at 8 o'clock in the morning on this Thursday and I met him and he explained to me what we were going to be doing. And he said, I think this is going to help. And I absolutely loved it. I walked through the doors. I met the guys and gals who were managing the place. And then I got to meet the visitors and I got to make them breakfast and we had a few hours of, you know, looking after people. And it was so wonderful. It was such an incredible experience that I begged Lindy, who was the lady who was looking after volunteers, I just said, can you put whatever you can do, fast track me through this initiation? What do I have to do? You know, follow all this training and all these regulations and get your, you know, police checks and all these things done. I said, just, I've got nothing to do. Like, I'm all yours. If you want me, I'll be here, you know. And so I went through all the stuff that you got to go through. And that was it. I was there every week, every Thursday, serving breakfast. And I shall be there tomorrow morning.
Wonderful. So you serve food. Do you lead sing-alongs, perhaps? Or?
Not yet. No. Not yet. No, I really actually wanted to keep it. And it's silly. I mean, now I'm a bit more relaxed. But when I first started and went in there, I didn't want to go in there proclaiming
as Emma
to be, or to be anything other than, hey, I'm Emma, I'm coming to volunteer, this is what I do. I didn't need to be saying, oh, and did you know I do this and you might know me from such blah blah blah. I was not into that at all. I wanted to escape all of that. Yeah. I think it was some weird needing of compartmentalizing things. I don't know what it was. I just didn't want to be yeah, doesn't want to be known as, you know, not that I was in...
Well, you didn't want to be the centre of attention.
Yeah.
It was about them. Something much bigger.
Totally.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, I just wanted to keep it separate. And then, of course, you know, you can't go for that long without someone asking you what you do or someone saying, hey, someone told me that blah, blah, blah. And then, it, you know, it's come out and yeah, it's a beautiful, lovely thing. They know and they get that feeling that I don't need it to be about me, even now, years on. But yeah. So maybe, I mean, yeah, look, Christmas time, there'll be some sing-alongs. I've got some mates in the visitors that they know what I do for a living, and we have a little sing-along every now and again.
Very honourable thing to be doing. and, of course, they have a drive at this time of the year also where people can donate a plate.
Donate a plate. I mean, it's such an incredible initiative for Wayside. They you know, there's the percentage of homelessness people, and we see certainly at this time of year it just escalates, you know. It's a tough time for so many people, and we see so many people come through our doors at that time of year. So this funding and this donation process, that just helps so much, you know, be able to, I think it's like $25-$27, you know, you're gonna be able to feed someone a really hearty, healthy Christmas dinner from, you know, whereas perhaps they wouldn't have been able to have that opportunity. So
yeah.
Super important. Yeah, there's a website. I'm unprepared. But I guess if you...
But if you look for the Wayside Chapel online...
Wayside Chapel, yeah, you'll find absolutely. It. And it's... I mean, it's, and of course, it's only for people who are in the position or who find themselves in the position where they can donate. You know, it's a tough time of year for many people. So if you are in the position where you can and you want to, it's certainly... I can attest it's a really, really good charity to help in.
Great thing to do.
Yeah.
Do you know what it means to miss New Orleans and miss her each night and day? I know I'm not wrong, the feeling's getting stronger the longer I stay away. Miss the moss-covered vines, the tall sugar pines where mockingbirds used to sing. And I long to see the lazy Mississippi a-hurrying into spring. The moonlight on that Creole tune that fills the air. I dream of white magnolias in June, and soon I'm wishing I were there. Do you know what it means to miss New
question for you. What good is melody? What good is music if it ain't possessing something sweet? It ain't the melody and it ain't the music. There's something else that makes this tune complete. What is that?
Oh my goodness. Well, it's jazz, baby. That's jazz. For sure. I love that. I love that. What a start to a podcast. It is. It's jazz. You know, the thing that is, yeah, there's something else that makes the tune complete. It is the life, I'd imagine, of what you experience when you're involved in this kind of music. It's a freedom, it's an expression, it's a chance to improvise, it's a chance to create, you know, it's, yeah, so many things.
What does it mean to miss New Orleans?
Is this how we're going to go for the next hour? Because I'm ready. No. I mean,
I'm going to
sharpen my tools.
With some gorgeous, gorgeous questions.
It's true.
I love that. I've played it on repeat recently. What does it mean to miss New Orleans? Your rendition.
Oh, I was going
to
say, my.
Yeah,
my,
you're,
oh,
absolutely
well.
Your rendition. Yeah, oh, yeah, thanks. Yeah. No, it's wonderful.
Yeah, what a tune. My goodness. I was introduced to that as a young teenager And it was the man himself who penned that arrangement, Mr. Ed Wilson, our Aussie own Ed Wilson, who penned that arrangement. I've been sinking my teeth into that for many years.
I didn't know it was an Australian.
Well, not an Australian song, an Australian arranger. Right. Yeah, the person who arranged it. It's an American standard, jazz standard, I'd imagine, or it's from a musical. What is that from? I think it's from the movie or the film. Do You Know What It Means to Miss New Orleans with Billie Holiday? And, yeah. But no, Ed Wilson from the Daily Wilson Big Band. He is a trombonist, an arranger, a writer. From, you know, he's, I think, what's Ed's now? Probably my dad's age. He's in his 80s. He's incredible. And that's that album that you heard that recording on, that little EP, is all arrangements of Ed Wilson's. And Ed came into my life in the 90s when I first started working with James Morrison. One of the first gigs I did back when I was 16 was go on the road with the big band. And as a high school student, I'd been singing with, you know, singing all these big band arrangements that were, many of them, arranged by this great Ed Wilson character. Ed Wilson, I'm hearing all this Ed Wilson. And then I think the week we were going on the road, I'd get the gig sheet faxed through in those days about who was in the big band tour. And it said in the trombone section, Ed Wilson, and I nearly passed out. I was like, what? I'm going to go on the road not only with James Morrison. That was a big deal enough as it is. And then Ed Wilson's going to be in the trombone section. And so, I met Ed. That's how I met Ed. And he generously kept giving me all his wonderful arrangements all through my life. And that's why that record that you've been listening to recently came about. It was a little dedication to all the arranging that Ed's done over the years.
What about all those famous jazz vocalists like Ella Fitzgerald, Louis Armstrong, Carmen McRae? Mm-hmm. Did you grow up with them?
I did.
When was your first exposure?
I really did, yeah. My parents, who are great fans of wonderful music, eclectic tastes, you know, they're fans of the Beatles, they're fans of rock and roll, British rock and roll, they're both from the UK. My mum has just always had a love for exactly who you said, Ella Fitzgerald. Frank Sinatra is one of her favourite singers, Louis Armstrong. Dad always loved the Rat Pack, you know, Dean Martin and all those sort of crooners. So it was always around the house as a youngster. But I don't, and I think it was always playing, so it was always around sort of seeping into me, but I didn't know it was calling
Osmosis.
For me. Yeah, it was, you know, my brother was in the same household and he didn't have an affiliation or end up having affiliation for it. So it was when I started high school in year 7, I had an incredible teacher there, a music teacher, who when he was fresh out of uni, this guy as well, Anthony Gullick, fresh out of uni, and he'd come in with gusto, you know, this is his first music posting, and he was a trumpet player and a big band lover himself. So in class he'd be shouting out and throwing out all these names, and I'd be like, oh yeah, I know Ella, and I know that, and well, why do you know that? Well, my mum plays this record. And you know, he'd say things like, well, if you like that, maybe you should check this out. And so that's when I really became diving into that genre of music.
And discovering those artists for the first time is so exciting, isn't it? When,
totally.
When somebody says, oh, listen to this Ella Fitzgerald album.
Yeah, absolutely.
Think, what the? Where? Yeah.
I know. And then when you've got, like you said, you've got something, or you've got one album of them, and they bring more to the table. It's fascinating. And it's so, you know, in hindsight, you realise how important that is that passing on of musical knowledge. You know, it's hugely, yeah.
It's really a genre that feeds the soul, isn't it? It's
I think so.
There's a lovely fluidity to it, or it's just so smooth.
Yeah, there's so many facets about it. I like to look at it, I see it as like a big umbrella, jazz, you know, and under that umbrella there's just so many sub-genres of it. There's just so many different areas you can dive into, you know. You can find that old school, you know, where we get the Great American Songbook from, you know, the 20s, 30s, 40s romantic, you know, Broadway shows and things like that. And then you can dive into bebop and you can dive into ballads. You can
dive
into
trad jazz.
Trad jazz.
I love as well, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, we're getting back to New Orleans, you know, though, there's Black funerals.
Right.
All followed by
the
jazz
processions.
Band.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Heavy. Yeah. There's just such, it's just such a huge, all-encompassing genre. You know, you can find so many things in it that exactly would soothe your soul in one way or the other.
Do you have eclectic tastes like your parents? Do you listen to other genres?
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, I definitely do. I mean, I do, as in I don't actively, I guess, go out and, you know, search for other things. But I'm exactly as open as I was back then in, you know, 1990 with my music teacher saying, hey, have you heard this? You know, a lot of friends and a lot of musicians are, you know, always with their influences passing them on. So, I do. I mean, it's definitely my first love is jazz and big band. And
well, in fact, on your albums, there are popular songs which are given a jazz treat.
Yeah, you're right. Exactly. Yeah. Like you're saying, like the Beatles. You know, I'm a big fan of the Beatles from my parents. My parents being completely obsessed with the Beatles. Up until a certain point, Mum was like, well, when they went to the Sgt. Pepper days, I lost them a bit. You know, she wasn't into the psychedelic acid-tripping phase. But up until then, you know, I was brought up listening to so much of it. And so much so was the bass player in my band, Phil Stack, a really heavy Beatles fan. And so with things like that, yeah, we take a song that we love, like Here, There and Everywhere or And I Love Her, and we've done, yeah, our little own sort of jazz arrangement of things like that. Also Adele, you know, I'm a huge fan of, if you're talking about modern day, nowadays vocalists, you know, I think Adele has got such an incredible sound that I've taken one of her tunes and put my own little stamp on it too. And there's another American vocalist, Yeba, who I just, you know, completely love, and she'd be more in the genre of kind of R&B soul, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm in awe of arrangers and vocalists who can take a particular genre and then turn it into something else.
You know? Oh, yeah, it's great. It's so much fun. Yeah, you can classify.
And you hear it anew. You hear it in a different way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's the key to, you know, it's just good music. It can be genreless, really. Yeah. You can make it whatever you want it to be when it's good music.
Your career is all about music. Do you enjoy periods of silence?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
I mean,
I really do.
You're at home after a tour and maybe you don't listen to anything.
For sure, 100%. Or even more of an example of being with my beautiful husband in the car. You know, Rod, my husband, who is from South America. And when I met him, you know, he opened me up to a whole new world of South American music that I thought I knew and loved. But he, you know, he brought in a whole new gamut of things to my musical ears. But for instance, you know, if I've, like you said, I've been on a tour or I've been on the road or I've just had a gig that night and I feel full. He knows now. We've been married for, you know, 10 years. He knows when I just feel full and overloaded that I prefer to have a silent car trip. You know, I just don't want to. But he can't do that. He's needing stimulation all the time. So if we're on a road trip somewhere, he'll just, yeah, he'll want to crank the playlist. And I'm like, I've just got to either go with it or I've got to go, no, babe, I can't do it. Just give me half an hour. Yeah, but it's a funny thing when you do. I definitely do feel overloaded. I wonder if you ever asked other people that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That they insist on silence sometimes just to rest the ear or to rest the brain or something. Oh, no. And maybe it's just a way of cleansing the palate or recharging.
I think so. Yeah, and because when you listen to something too, you know, as an artist, as a performer, as a musician, it's more often it's so lovely and comforting to listen to it, but while you are listening to it, you're also analyzing it, and you're, you know, you're musically not picking it apart, but you're analyzing what's going on. Or even, like, you know, for instance too, if you're as a working vocalist, you're going to a session, you know, you get booked to go and do TV commercials and things like that, where you've got to listen to a track. There's not much necessarily music in front of you to learn as such. It's an oral thing where they play, oh, wouldn't it be like this? And so you're listening to something for a really short amount of time and you're analysing everything that's going on, because then you've got to work and you've got to reproduce that sound or create something. And so it's almost like, yeah, when something comes on, you're never not analysing. You're enjoying it, but if you're not having to work, but you're always listening and noticing bits. So that, I think it is definitely that brain rest that you need. I'm rambling.
No, it's fascinating. I mean, and that just points to, again, you know, it's one thing to have the vocal chops, but there's that innate musicianship, which is so vital as well, which not everybody has. You talk about analysing. I hear that a lot of musicians are great at maths. Are you good at maths?
I was really good at math. I'm definitely not saying I'm a great musician, but I am. I was really good at math in high school. I loved mathematics. Before I got discovered, for want of a better term, by James Morrison, I was in the top of, like, you know, grade three, unit three math, like, you know, the high, heavy, hardcore stuff. I used to love algebra and, you know, doing all that stuff. And then I went on tour and music swept me up and all my study went by the wayside. But
that talent with math must come into your musicianship, especially something like scatting.
Possibly time and rhythm.
Timing and numbers.
Definitely. I mean, rhythm is such a huge part of music too. I mean, analytically, that's what you're, for me, and especially with jazz, it's all about rhythm and time. But yeah, numbers, math, yeah, for sure. It's definitely a huge part of it. Yeah. And I guess that is, yeah, that's that analytic side just buzzing.
Oh, the shark has
pretty teeth, dear, and he shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has Mackie there, and he keeps it out of sight. When that shark bites, when it bites with his teeth there, scarlet billows, they start to spread. Fancy white gloves though, where's Mackie there? So there's not a trace of red. On the sidewalk, on one cent them oil in, there lies a body and it's oozing life. Someone sneaking up out on the corner. Tell me, could it be Mac the Knife? Well, from a tugboat down by the river going slow, there lies a summit bay. It's dropping down where the seaman is just for the waiting. Betcha if I do one, I'll make it boys back in town. Well, Lou and Mel, well, he had disappeared here. Oh, I could draw a knife, don't worry about all his cash.
Teacher you had, which yes. ignited the passion in you. But of course it was a school concert where Mr. Morrison was present and mm-hmm. yes, certainly discovered you.
Yeah.
Tell us about that night. What was the concert? What was Mr. Morrison doing at
Kirrawee High School?
Kirrawee High.
He'd been booked by this said wonderful music teacher of ours, Anthony Gullick. So Anthony was, like I'd said, a really big jazz fan. You know, he'd loved playing trumpet and loved big band music, and he was always just so passionate about giving opportunities to us kids, you know, and always pushing us and inspiring us to follow our hearts and do what we love. And hey, you know, like I said, check this out, listen to this, and yeah, just totally igniting that fire in you all the time. And I believe possibly the night was probably something to do with us raising money maybe for a tour that we were going to go on. Possibly, I'm quite sure we were. I know that we were heading as a band to South Africa at one point to do a tour of the Grahamstown Arts Festival, which was mind blowing as young teenage high school kids. It was either that or whether it was just a general concert for the public. I'm not quite sure. You know, like a bit of a coup to have this wonderful musical evening, and he'd booked the James Morrison band to come, And what happens with that is when you book James, he comes in the afternoon and he workshops the school band, and the structure of a concert would be the first half of the concert being James and our school band featuring with us and, you know, showcasing all that he'd worked on in the afternoon with us kids and us being super excited, you know, all that sort of stuff. And then the second half of the concert would be the James Morrison band and us kids would sit in the audience and watch him do a show, you know. So that's how it went. That's how it unfolded. And in the afternoon, I remember it again vividly. I can remember standing on the hall, on the stage of the school hall, and the side doors bursting open and James sort of flumbling in, carrying all these instruments, you know, under his arms. He didn't just have his trumpet, he had trombone and all sorts of other things, saxophones. And he walked in and he walked down past the stage, and I was up on the stage, I looked down, and he just looked up, and I remember seeing his beaming face going, "Hi," as he does, "Hi." And I just went, "Oh my gosh, James Morrison, you know, it's crazy." Mum and Dad were, you know, big fans of him. And so, yeah, then we got into workshopping. I sort of was sitting as the vocalist in the band. I was sitting to the side of the stage just watching all my mates, you know, go through all the tunes that we were going to play that night. And then finally, at the end of the, towards the end of the rehearsal, Anthony, my music teacher, said to James, "So we've got this young singer, this young vocalist with the band, you know, probably do a tune with her tonight. You know, if you, okay if you have a listen?" And he's like, "Oh, yeah, yeah." And looking at his watch, probably thinking, "When's dinner?" And so we pulled out Ed Wilson's arrangement of the great tune from the Thripney Opera, Mack the Knife. And we started playing it, and I remember James was just looking across the room at me singing this song. And I often, Peter, as a school kid, was getting in trouble for not having my shirt tucked in at school. I was a bit of a tomboy, and I'd wear a suit, you know, full shirt and tie and jacket to school. And I was a bit of a scruffback. I wouldn't have my shirt tucked in, so I'm thinking, shit, he's staring at me because I haven't got my shirt tucked in, shit. I'm singing along, and then at the end of the song, he came up to me, sort of like beelined across the stage, and I never forget, he said, the first thing he said to me was, "Who do you listen to?" And I sort of was like a little bit of a stunned mullet, said, "Ella, Sarah, Billy, Carmen, Shirley Horn." I sort of like rattled off, and he just went, "Okay."
That's quite a faculty of teachers.
It's true, yeah. Yeah, I think, yeah, he was checking out if I had a cool school, and I definitely had a cool school. So he just looked at me and went, "Uh-huh, mm-hmm." And that was it. And I was sort of left there. And I'm thinking, what does that mean? And then he walked off, and completely unbeknownst to me, all of us kids went home and, you know, we showered and got ready for the concert in the evening. And unbeknownst to me, he'd gone up to Anthony as we'd left the school hall, and he said, "So if I get that young girl up to sing with me in the second half of my band, is she going to be all right?" And Anthony, knowing me, you know, I'd combust, you know. He just cool as a cucumber said, yeah, she should be fine. Should be fine, knowing that I wouldn't be fine, as in I would freak out and I wouldn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do, you know, working with a school band.
I was very young. You didn't have a lot of stagecraft, I guess, at that stage.
Well, no stagecraft, and certainly no idea of how to work in a functioning small group jazz band. Mm. You know, I mean, I was singing with my school band, and I had been given the chart, and that's what the band plays for an intro, and then you come in and you sing this bit, and then the band play a solo, and then you come back in at letter B here, and then this is the end of the tune. That's kind of all I knew, or I knew to do physically. So really, you know, to be thrown into that, so that's exactly what happened then. The evening concert came, we did our first half, then we had a break, we were all at the back of the hall, and sure, you know, lo and behold, halfway through his set, we're at the back of the hall watching, you know, and somewhat he started saying a speech to the audience coming up. "We met some kids this afternoon, and, you know, and this and this and this," and we're all thinking, "Oh, he's talking about so-and-so on the trumpet, you know, he's going to get him up." And then suddenly he said, "So is Emma still at the back of the hall?" And all my mates started, you know, elbowing me. I'm like, shit, he's talking about, oh my God. And so we just had to get her up. And I remember marching to the stage, you know, through the aisle of this school hall full of, you know, hundreds of people. And I thought, oh my God, I'm walking panicked, thinking, well, I'm walking in, what am I going to do? What's happening? I have no idea. It was just all of that being in the moment, but completely out of body, you know, experience. And we got up on stage, and he did that thing of like, "So what do you want to do?" And I don't know. "What do you think?" And he said, "Well, do you know this song?" And he played a little bit on the piano, because he could play the piano, of course. And I said, "No." And he generally said, "Well, do you know this song?" And he played a little, and I, "No." And I'm thinking, by this stage, he's probably thinking, oh my God, what have I done? And he said, "Well, what do you know? You know, what have you done with your school band that you'd like to do?" And I said, "Oh, God Bless the Child, you know, Billie Holiday." And he's like, "Great, perfect. What key do you sing it in?" And I went, "Oh, what, I don't know, whatever the band chart's written in, what key, I don't know what key I sing it in." Like, completely, I just had no idea. And the guitarist, Dave Corton, at the time, he saved me. He started noodling around in B-flat, sang it. He said, "Sing a bit of the melody," and sang a bit. He said, "Yeah, B-flat, you're going to sing B-flat." I said, "Oh, okay, B-flat, great." And then they started, and off we went. I don't even know if I came in at the right place or not. I have no idea what happened, but we got through that song, and I thought, God, my life could be over now. This is terrifying. And he said, "Cool, so yeah, what about a swinger?" And I'm like, oh my God, it hasn't ended yet. He wants another song. And he said, do you know Gershwin's They Can't Take That Away From Me? And everything in my being was screaming, well, no, I don't. I mean, I know the song, but I don't really know it to sing it. So I'm thinking, I don't know what happened. It's like fate or something. But everything inside me was saying, if you don't say yes, this is it. Like, this is the end. This is ridiculous.
You were effectively being auditioned.
I was, you? Pretty much, yeah. So I just, something inside of me said, yep, uh-huh. And like I said, Peter, with Mum and Dad, you know, I'd had Ella and Louie playing around the house all the time. I knew They Can't Take That Away From Me, yeah. You know, from hearing the sound of it and maybe a little bit of the lyric. But literally looking down, you know, five rows in the audience, there's my mum, this quiet little bee, you know, sitting there, and she's looking up at me going, you don't know that. And I'm like, I know I don't know that. And I've told this story many times, like it's no word of a lie. My mother got me through that by singing and mouthing the words from the fifth row of the audience looking up.
The way you wear your hat.
Yeah, pretty much. She'd do that and she'd do this little action, sip
the
your
you
tea.
Drink your tea.
Yeah, yeah, the whole way you hold your knife, the way we dance. So she did all these contained little movements, you know, and she's shy as a mouse as it comes. But anyway, I managed to somehow get through it. And yeah, that was it. The next week I got the call from... His agent called me as I, you know, trunched home from school and threw my school bag on the kitchen floor, and the phone rang, and that was it. Hey, hi Emma, this is Roy Ferrum from James Morrison's office, this dark American voice, and he said, James has got a gig next week down your way, he'd like to book you for that gig. In fact, he'd like you to be the singer in his band. And I was like, what? What? What is
that?
How
old were you?
16.
Wow.
Yeah, and I just, yeah, it was total baptism by fire. No idea.
What did your folks think of that, of their 16-year-old daughter sort of running off to join the musical circus?
Right. I think it's a good question. You should definitely ask them that one day. I know that they were huge fans of James and they were really excited, but I think absolutely they were terrified at the same time. I was 16 going into this world of...
Of men?
Of men, yeah. Of, you know, older musicians, of jazz, like, you know, and certainly in the 80s and 90s, you know, it wouldn't have had the reputation that it has these days, you know, so I think they were
terrified. And playing at licensed venues too, I guess.
I was underage. Many of the venues that we went to in the early days, I wasn't allowed in through the club. I'd have to come in through around the back through the kitchen and straight to the dressing room, and I wasn't allowed to enter the premises and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And I'd be studying for my HSC backstage while we're going on tour and all that kind of stuff.
Was there any sort of chaperone that had to travel with you?
No, not really, not in the early days. Certainly later on, my mum used to come on the road with me a bit, purely because John Morrison in those days, James's brother, and his wife Nat at the time were having a baby, and so mum would come and help babysitting duties for them, which I was trying to do, and sing in the band. So then she'd be on the road for a little bit. But no, in the early days, no, it was really much my parents driving me, because I didn't drive at that stage either. My parents driving me to all these places and then, yeah, just sort of having to find my way through. Yeah, certainly an interesting experience, eye-opening experience at a young age. You know, I had to grow up pretty quick.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And as you say, a baptism of fire, working with a live audience. And...
Yeah, a live audience and in a genre that I really was learning on the job what I was doing, you know, and learning about jazz and just about craft and musicianship and just simple, even just break it down to even simple things like form of a song, you know, what keys you sing things in. It was great. It was all the things that you'd go to university, I guess, for, or in high school and then into university to do a jazz course to learn. You'd go there to learn all these things that I was just having to apply immediately and learning them straight away, kind of thing.
And there would be rehearsal times where you would...
You'd think no? So. No, not particularly.
Really? Turning up and doing
it was
your thing?
So cool. And, you know, I think anyone you'd ask who was in James's band in those days or before I came along or certainly afterwards too, he has such a relaxed demeanour and such confidence, I think, in this music, you know, that it's a good way, I guess, of him... you know, making you do the work, you know, like I think in that first phone call, it was like, you know, what do I have to do? And I think his manager at the time would have said something like, well, just get a few songs up your sleeve and, you know, come along. And I remember so vividly that first gig. It was down in Sutherland, which was close to where my parents and I grew up. And we went, I turned up and I had my little suit on, like my little, you know, not my school suit, but a different suit. And I was just terrified and walked into the back room and there was James and his brother, John, and they are obsessed with planes and boats and cars, and they have all these magazines because they're both pilots. And they were reading through all these boat magazines and car magazines, and it was just like turning into a backstage, like just like mates catching up and hanging. There was no talk of music. There was nothing really. And I sort of sat down at the table in the corner and sort of like, hi, and just terrified of what was going on. And then just a few minutes before we went on, James is like, oh, so you've got, you know, you've got a couple of tunes. And I was like, oh, yeah, yep, yep, yeah. And he said, oh, we'll do that. You know, they can't take that away from me like we did, and God Bless a Child, and what else have you got? And I said, maybe one note samba, you know, like a samba, like a Latin thing. Great, great, great. He said, all right, I'll call you up probably about the second song. And so I'd be sitting backstage just thinking, okay, wow. And then he'd call me on stage and that was it. And I'd learn what an intro was, and I'd learn when I came in, and I'm sure people were soloing and I might have come in at the bridge in the wrong part of a tune or something like that, but they all saved me. And no one really said anything too much, but if I did something or if James needed something from me, he'd just gently guide me and suggest, you know, maybe do this or that. And that's sort of how it went. It was just really super just in the doing of the do.
And then eventually, I guess you built up a silent language, a nod or a twinkle in the eye or a wink or a...
100%.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Just to communicate with each other on stage during the performance.
Well, yeah.
Performance.
I mean...
Where are you going to go?
Totally. Yeah. That's such a huge part of this music that I was discovering, is that it is 100% about open communication. You have to have your eyes and your ears open at all times. And it was a gradual learning for me. I mean, I guess it was an instant learning, but it still took me a long time to develop that language of communication. Mm. And yeah, just learning everything about, yeah.
Working with the microphone.
Absolutely. Yeah. Bringing that into it as well. Yeah. All these things. And I look back now and I think, yeah, gosh, it was a lot probably, but I was immersed in it. I loved it. I thought I was having the time of my life, you know. And I certainly, there were certainly points where I needed part and times, you know, where I needed a bit of, you know, hard line. When I said there was no rehearsal, we'd often get to places, you know, down the track, and there'd be sound checks and James would just be on the piano just rambling away and playing, and then I'd come over and I'd suggest a tune and he'd go, oh, great, and then we'd just be working out an arrangement or something, you know, like that. So that would definitely evolve. But, yeah, that thing of having to have your eyes and ears open all the time is integral in this kind of music, because you're creating instantly with improvisation. As in, when I finish a chorus and the guitarist takes a solo, it's improvised. He's making it up. It's anything could happen. He could take a chorus, he could take two, he could, you know, throw it back to me, and then maybe we're trading, you know, certain bars of music. It was just, yeah, it was a complete massive learning curve.
When we're young, we feel we're pretty invincible.
Right.
What about vocal care? Were you aware of, you know, that you had to look after your voice? And
yeah, I really wasn't in the early days.
Yeah. I would assume you wouldn't be.
No, I was just doing it naturally. As in, like, when I was younger, you know, young days, early days, before all this happened, you know, I'd be in dance classes and singing classes and have, you know, vocal coaches, and we'd sit in groups of 30, us kids, and we'd, you know, have singing lessons. So you'd warm up and then you'd sing your piece. And so I knew all those little things, but I'd never had a private lesson before. And it was probably a year or two in to touring with James where I was feeling exhausted, and I didn't know what I was doing, and I didn't know why these things were happening. And I became really, you know, interested and quizzical about, yeah, what I've got to do, because I actually need stamina. I need to, you know, there must be a way. And I found a wonderful classical teacher, actually, of all things. It was a classical teacher called Patricia Ortel, and I went to her. Do you know Patricia?
I know the name. Yeah, I don't know Patricia, but I certainly know that she's taught a lot of great
people. Yeah, she did. I'm not sure if she's still with us. I believe she's not, but I spent quite a lot of time with her, and it was the best thing I'd ever did. It was a classical, you know, it was classical technique. It was learning all about warming up, warming down, just technique, like you were saying, about singing, of how to sing and what to do, you know, to not harm yourself, which is what I was going down that path of. And so I learnt invaluable lessons with her, and I still do my warm-up that she taught me all those years ago, which is probably, you know, I've been, next year will be 30 years since this started, so it's probably like 28 years ago. I still listen to her little warm-up thing that I do.
When you've got a gig? Or, mm-hmm.
Or anytime.
Do you sing every day?
Not every day. If I try to keep my voice active every day. I definitely do, you know, if I have a break and I need a break, I'll you know, I'll be silent and I'll have a rest for a while. But then I know I need to, you know, if I had some time off, like a holiday or something, I need to get ready for the week that's coming ahead. I'll start making sound again and warming up and, yeah, doing all the things.
One of the vocal styles of jazz is scatting.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that, because it's just amazing. It just...
Yeah, isn't it?
Is it like leaping off a cliff and you don't know where you're going with it? Or
totally can be. Yeah, sometimes.
I imagine it's a bit like yodeling.
Well, yeah, I mean, possibly. In a way. Yeah, you're right. It is. It's just a different syllables and different sounds. Yeah. So scatting is basically, you know, if you want to just break it down, and it's just improvising. That's like I was saying before, if you're in a band situation and you hear me sing the head of, they can't take that away from me. And then suddenly, you know, I'll pass it over to the pianist or the guitarist and they start playing a solo. So basically, I mean, you know, you know what they're doing. They've got the form of a song, which I've just sung the melody of. And it's a cyclic, you know, music is very cyclic. So it starts here and finishes there, the song. So they're cycling the song. And what they're doing is creating a new melody, essentially, over the top of what I've just sung. So it's the same chord structure underneath. This is a melody that's been written specifically to fit in with those chords. Now you can have some fun. You can create your own melody, and you can, yeah, it's like a painting almost. It's like you're creating a piece over this same fundamental base that you've been given by the writer. So it's super exciting. Sometimes, and I absolutely don't profess to be good at it at all. I could study and I could be much more diligent in my homework and become much better at it than I am. But I certainly do have fun doing it. I love it.
Oh, I think you're extraordinary.
I'm really not.
It's so exciting to listen to.
Oh, yeah, I know. Thank you, but I'm really not. I can give you some other vocalists whom I admire who I'm inspired by, who are absolutely phenomenal improvisers. They're great.
Well, yeah, that's it, improvisation, isn't it? You sort of, the sounds that are made, well, as you say, it's all vowel sounds or...
Yeah, it's any, I mean, gosh, listen
any
to...
Any sounds.
Yeah, Ella Fitzgerald. If you listen to Ella, there's this great solo that I've loved, you know, ever since I was young and first introduced to Ella. It's her live in Newport doing Airmail Special.
Right.
And it's this thing, you know, and then she goes into this E-Owl. And she just goes off into this, you know, and then you'll hear her go. And she's just, it's just every possible sound that you could think could come out of a body, she does, and it's just unbelievable. Your jaw is on the floor, you know, by the end of it. It's incredible.
Wow. We got away from school a little bit. I was going to ask, did you learn any other instruments?
I did. Yeah, I did. I was, my first instrument at school might have been the guitar, I think, for a little while. And then it was the tenor saxophone. I went into the tenor, which I loved. And I had a really fantastic teacher of the tenor saxophone, a great New Zealand saxophonist by the name of Roger Mannins. He was my school teacher
for
saxophone. I loved that. What else did I dabble in school? Probably about it. Oh, piano. I studied piano for, you know, quite a few years. But I was never studying jazz piano. I was going to piano lessons and learning classical pieces and things like that. And I my love for that just sort of, it just, yeah, teetered off a bit.
Right.
Especially when singing, you know, took over, and especially working with James, that became my number one kind of priority. But yeah, I loved the tenor saxophone. We used to sit in my room and try and transcribe and play along with Sonny Stitt solos and things like that.
Prior to meeting James, what was your heart set on becoming a professional musician? Or?
No way. I didn't even know you could be one.
Right.
No,
right.
Not at all.
So what did you have in mind for a vocation?
If I'm completely honest with you, I'd probably just done or I was about to do my work experience in those days in year 11 at school. I might have done it, I can't remember. My father was in the airlines. He was in with Qantas for 30 years. So as a kid, we were, you know, spending a lot of time travelling back to London to see family and things like that with staff travel and, you know, in the early days when it was great. Nice. And so I was thinking, yeah, I'd probably love a career in travel like Dad. And then on the other hand, you know, I really have such a huge passion for animals. I was like, oh, maybe I could be a vet, you know, a vet or travel. Music was not in my scope because I didn't know that you could be. I was really weird because I grew up in my, you know, my high school and in my bedroom and I'd listen to, you know, all the things that I'd love. I'd have my, you know, my cassette tapes on with, you know, Bachelor Girl and Kate Sobrano and Tina Arena and John Farnham and all those singers that I loved in the 80s and 90s. But it never really twigged, you know, I wasn't that bright. I didn't ever twig that was something that I could do.
Yep.
That was a job, you know. It was like, oh, that's if you're a star, you know, that kind of thing. So I never, you know, not until that night that it happened at school was I thinking that I would do this professionally. Yeah. Not at all.
Well, people around you were obviously recognising that you had some talent.
I mean,
you participated in the Talent Development Project.
Yeah, indeed.
Which is a New South Wales government schools thing.
Yes, it is, yeah, and such a fantastic program. You're right. I mean, I had potential seen in me from, you know, my music teacher, Anthony, who'd got me singing with the band. So he was instrumental in getting me into the Talent Development Project. Yeah, and I had, you know, lots of people, you know, mentioning to me, oh, you'd sing a concert at school or we'd play at the Manly Jazz Festival as kids and as a school band and you'd get, you know, compliments and things. But I still just wasn't, I was loving it, don't get me wrong. I didn't think I wanted to end or wanted it to end, but I had no idea, or I think in year 10, end of year 10 or 11 at start when I met James, I wasn't really thinking about the end because I just loved school so much. I loved being in, I was, you know, top of my drama class and top of the music class. I loved being in drama and music and I just didn't ever want to leave school. I just didn't want it to end. I'd be terrified. I didn't want it to have to be in the real world. And so I wasn't thinking about what I'd have to do. I just really was immersing myself in that moment of high school and never wanting it to end.
Yeah.
So I just didn't, I wasn't thinking about what I was going to do until it kind of fell in my lap and found me and, yeah, led me down a path of 30 years later, here I am chatting to you.
Well, it's a wonderful path. It's a career that's taken you all around the world. You've performed for Diana, Princess Diana, Mary.
Yeah.
Did you get to meet them?
I did. I met Diana, which was really wonderful. And that was part of school. That was towards the end of school. I think I'd finished school, or maybe I was in year 12, and we'd been invited to play the national anthem and some music for her at one of those Victor Chang luncheons that she did. Yeah. So it would have been in the late 90s, 95 or something like that, 94, 95. And I remember there was just like a sea of wall of photographers behind her as she came forward and shook our hands and she just said, oh, it's a bit daunting, isn't it? And I said, yeah, it's crazy, you know, crazy. She said, oh, it's wonderful. She was really loving and, yeah, super giving. It was pretty phenomenal.
And Keith and Nicole, performed at their wedding.
I did,
The wedding waltz? The first dance?
The bridal waltz, yeah, it was. Keith had requested... Etta James, she made that song famous, At Last.
Yeah,
yeah, so we sang At Last. But we also did a whole night of big band music tuned for the wedding. That was really beautiful. Was that back in 2006, I think it was, back then? Seems like a lifetime ago. It was really fun.
I love big bands, but I guess they're really cost prohibitive, aren't they? Because there's so many personnel that you need to...
A lot of musos, to carry around. I mean, if I had my way, I'd be doing big band weekly. I'd be touring the country with my big band. You know, I certainly, whenever I get the opportunity, and thankfully I have, thanks to my dear friend Olivia Ansell at the Sydney Festival, she's booked me a few times with the Emma Pask big band, which I've loved doing over the past couple of years.
You sometimes wish that you were born in another period, you know, the 40s with Glenn Miller or...
Totally.
Or somebody, you know, where people went out every Saturday night to a big dance and there was a big band.
I know, and it was celebrated, yeah. I mean, I don't know if I... Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to be living in this time, but I'd love to have something teleport me back to those times and dive in and check it out.
That'd be great.
That would be so cool.
Yeah. And what makes a good jazz song? You know, when you look for a song to sing, what has to appeal for you?
I think it's that that combination of things for me. It's certainly a beautiful melody is important. So sound, you know, the beautiful melody that's structured over a beautiful set of changes, which are chords, you know, that's that harmonic side, which makes your heart feel warm, lovely things. Melody, I love a beautiful melody. And then, you know, for me, it's lyrical content. You know, I'm a hopeless romantic.
Yeah.
And I just love diving into a really emotive song, you know. So, I mean, having said that, that's what I'm thinking, you know, when you ask me about that, I'm thinking about a beautiful ballad or something like that that's, you know, which I love. I entitled one of my first independent albums after it was Some Other Spring, which is Beautiful Ballad, which is one of my favourite songs. But then also diving into the ridiculousness of things as well. You know, I love rhythm. I love up-tempo songs, which have crazy paths through them, you know, and telling a fun story and the comical side of things too. So, yeah, what makes it great? Yeah, I mean, and then making the song great is fantastic musicians to play music with and create it with.
Most songs have that love component, don't they?
They do.
They're about love. Even, you know, do you know what it means to miss New Orleans?
It's still a love.
It's about a love for a city. Mm. Or it's about lost love.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that's really, love is all, wouldn't you say?
High emotions.
I mean, it is. It's all that we have, really, as us humans. It's such an integral part of our being and who we are and how we operate.
Yeah. Mm. You've been touring for 30 years.
I know.
Do you still enjoy it? Is it tough living out of a suitcase at times?
Yeah, it's tough.
Yeah.
I love it. I often think, I shudder to think, you know, it's been 30 years. Am I still going to be able to do this for another 30? I hope so. You know, but it does get tiring, sure. I look back at the early days, you know, if you said 30 years, I look back at the early days and on the road in the 90s and you were just so young and full of life and things were easy, you know, late night gigs to 2 a.m., with a 5 a.m. lobby call. It was exciting, you know, and we often in those days too, we'd get up and go to the plane and James would be flying us around, you know, in the wee small hours of the morning everywhere, you know, from Bankstown Airport, we'd be flying all around domestically, all around, you know, the state. So it was a whirlwind of touring. And I never really, I mean, you probably got tired back in those days, but you didn't feel exhausted like you do now. I can do a weekend or a run of four shows and I'm absolutely spent. But I mean, I think it's so much part of who I am is what I do, and I can't deny that. It is. It's just, it's all I've ever known. It's all I've loved doing, you know. So I hope I don't ever tire of it. Yeah. I'd imagine I'll still be doing it.
I suspect you won't.
Mm, thanks.
Now, of course, if any listeners want to indulge more of Emma Pask, you have a few recordings available.
Got a few, yeah.
Yeah, which people can stream or certainly purchase.
I mean, look, purchasing would be lovely.
Is better, yeah, is better.
Yeah, it is. It is better. But I mean, yeah, the way things have gone these days, you know, music at the touch of your fingers is super convenient. So yeah, I've delved into the world of Spotify and have my music available digitally too. But I recently just released my latest recording, which I think I released in 2022. Are you like me, Peter, that after COVID, you can't remember what happened?
Yeah.
In 2021, 22,
20, it was effectively a 2.5 year period, wasn't it? Did that really happen?
Did it happen?
At the time when you were in it.
That's right.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Will it ever end?
Will it ever end? Exactly. And now it has ended. What did I do then? And what was 2021 like? And I think I released this last year. I know I recorded it in 2019, just before it hit. So I'd had it almost complete and ready. But I released it in 2022, but I decided for the first time to release a vinyl, do a vinyl run of this latest album, Dream of Life, that I've done, which, is really cool. And a lot of people are responding to it. I take it around.
Do you sell that at your gigs?
I sell more, you know, more records than, I still sell CDs too, which is an amazing thing. People still buy CDs. But I sell a lot of records, yeah, it's a wonderful thing. Most people are going back to getting those turntables.
And they can find that at your website.
Terrific
website.
Yeah.
Which is
emmapask.com.
Easy.
I know, it's pretty easy. Yeah. Easy.
Well, emmapask.com, thank you so much for joining the Stages podcast. It's been a wonderful chat. It's been really lovely to talk to you after hearing you on loop for the last couple of weeks.
And
I'm going to go and put it on again when you go.
Oh, gosh. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Em.
It's been lovely to chat.
Emma Pask has recorded several albums, which are available online to purchase and stream. They are all sublime and delivered by an artist of exceptional skill, intuition, and gusto. She is indeed the real thing. Thanks for joining us in this episode. It's always great to have your company. I'm Peter Ayers. Keep well, keep warm, stay safe, and I'll catch you next time on Stages.
Streets.